You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison, Wisconsin.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
Welcome to Worldview, your weekly source for news and analysis from around the world, right here on community-supported radio, WORT 89.9 FM.
Good evening, and welcome to the Sunday, April 13th edition of Worldview. I'm Lee Rowe, and I'm your host. And later in the program, we'll have Dr. Alhajian Jai in the studio. It's been a while since we've heard about his efforts with Project 1808 in Koinadugu College in Sierra Leone, and his participation in efforts to improve public health through coordination and research in Africa and globally. So we'll talk to him at about half past the hour. But first, we have the news.
Gabon's military leader, General Brice Oligui Nguema, won yesterday's presidential election with more than 90% of the vote, according to provisional results released today. Nguema led a coup in 2023 that ended a 60-year dynasty of the Bongo family. News agencies reported that some opposition heavyweights who could have posed a serious political challenge were excluded from the race, and critics said that the new constitution and electoral code were designed to give Oligui Nguema the presidency. Nguema ran against seven other candidates, and his main challenger received 3% of the votes, with over 70% of the registered voters participating. The election was largely peaceful, with some observers and candidates praising the conduct of the polls. The small oil and timber-rich Central African nation has a population of just 2.5 million people. Despite its resources, about 35% of the population live below the poverty line of $2 a day. Oligui Nguema's victory brings him a 7-year mandate and the resources to tackle the corruption and bad governance that characterized the Bongo's reign.
The Zimbabwe government announced its first payment under a 2020 compensation agreement between the state and local white farmers, in which Zimbabwe committed to pay $3.5 billion for farmland it seized more than two decades ago. When Zimbabwe gained independence in 1980, ending decades of white minority rule, most of the country's most fertile land was owned by some 4,000 white farmers. In 2000, President Robert Mugabe supported land invasions by government forces and vigilante groups to redistribute to black people in what they claimed was the restitution for dispossession of British colonial rule. However, Mugabe and his cronies took nearly 40% of about 35 million acres confiscated for themselves, according to a 2010 investigation by a local news outlet, Zim Online. Agricultural production, which had accounted for 40% of exports, plunged and the economy collapsed. The move also brought international condemnation and locked the country out of the global financial system. when President Emmerson Mnangagwa replaced Mugabe in a 2017 coup, he sought to engage Western governments to restore ties by committing to paying compensation. Analysts say the land payment marks an important step in repairing relations with Western nations and avoiding international judgments against Zimbabwe.
Hong Kong's oldest pro-democracy political group, the Democratic Party, was told in February by government officials to disband, and at a special meeting today, 90% of members supported the move. Founded in 1994, just prior to the return of Hong Kong to Chinese control, the party has been a leading voice for civil liberties and democratic reform inside of China. At its peak, it would often win majorities of the popular vote in Hong Kong and control the most seats in the Legislative Council. Yong Sum, co-founder and former chairperson of the party, told the Associated Press about the closure, saying, quote, "I'm not very happy about it, but I can see if we refuse the call to disband, we may pay a very huge price for it," unquote. After pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong in 2019, China cracked down on dissident political activity, including a new national security law that led to Democratic Party members being jailed, including two ex-party chairmen and to many other political groups being shut down. A second vote to complete the process of disbanding will be held later this year.
Renewed fighting in Myanmar broke out this week after a brief period of calm while the country struggled to deal with the consequences of a 7.7 magnitude earthquake that hit the region on March 28th. After the quake, a ceasefire was called by an alliance of three rebel groups, and the military government declared its own ceasefire on April 2nd. According to the military junta, the earthquake killed at least 3,649 people to date and left more than 5,000 injured. Hundreds of aftershocks have been felt, including this morning when a major 5.5 magnitude quake shook the center of the country. No group is taking credit for the renewed fighting, and a statement from the ruling military council said, quote, "We will respond if military bases are attacked without reason," unquote. The UN Human Rights Office had received reports of at least 14 attacks by the military as of Friday, and the UN said, quote, "Over 6.3 million people are in immediate need of humanitarian assistance."
Leaders from Mexico and Brazil, Latin America's two largest economies, said on Wednesday that they will work to strengthen economic ties amid the market chaos caused by unpredictable U.S. tariffs. Presidents Claudia Sheinbaum of Mexico and Luis Inácio Lula da Silva of Brazil met during a regional summit in Honduras to strategize how international economies can respond to escalating tariffs and increased deportation of Latin American migrants. Following the meeting, Lula posted on X, quote, "We decided to further strengthen relations between our two countries by promoting regular meetings between our governments and the business sectors of Brazil and Mexico," unquote. Despite U.S. President Donald Trump's announcement of a 90-day suspension of increased tariffs on all countries other than China, international leaders have recognized the importance of reliable trade alternatives to the U.S. Many U.S. partners and allies have expressed resentment toward U.S. trade and immigration policies that have caused increasing human rights concerns. During the summit, Sheinbaum said, quote, "Today, more than ever, is a good time to recognize that Latin America and the Caribbean require unity and solidarity," unquote.
A congressional committee in Peru has dismissed an investigation into whether the country's president, Dina Boluarte, accepted expensive gifts as bribes while serving as an elected official. Boluarte was alleged to have a collection of watches and jewelry worth over $500,000, which she accepted as illegal bribes while serving as president. The investigation led to a raid of Boluarte's residence after she refused to attend hearings regarding the allegations. This marked the first time in Peru's history that police forcibly entered the home of a sitting president. The Peruvian government later referred to the raid as disproportionate and unconstitutional. Boluarte categorically denied the allegations, claiming that the investigation was politically motivated and illegal. Boluarte became president after her predecessor, Pedro Castillo, was impeached for trying to dissolve Congress and rule by decree. Leading into the last year of the presidential term, Boluarte faces single-digit approval ratings and an additional probe into her conduct regarding a 2-week leave of absence for nose surgery during which she did not delegate powers. According to the BBC, the committee's decision to dismiss the bribery investigation also shields Boluarte from impeachment while she remains in power. However, she may still face criminal charges after the term ends and she loses presidential immunity.
Arab and Muslim countries, including Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Libya, condemned Israel's order to close Jerusalem schools operated by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, or UNRWA. The countries called on the international community to assume its responsibilities in ending Israel's violations and crimes against the Palestinians. They reminded the world that, quote, the right to education is a fundamental right guaranteed by international human rights laws and conventions, unquote. UNRWA is a United Nations agency established in 1949 that provides humanitarian aid, education, health care, relief, social support services, and infrastructure development to over 6.5 million registered Palestinian refugees and their descendants in the Near East. With support from the U.S., Israel has been resolute in ending or reducing the role of the agency. Last Tuesday, Israeli police served all UNRWA schools in the Shafat refugee camp in Jerusalem with orders to close within 30 days. Human rights and humanitarian organizations described this as a dangerous escalation targeting the social and educational fabric of Palestinians in the Holy City. Continued Israeli pressure threatens UNRWA's existence and the ability to perform its duties.
Israeli warplanes struck the Al Ahli Baptist Hospital in Gaza City, taking it out of service. The hospital, which serves over a million Palestinians in northern Gaza, had already been the site of one of the deadliest Israeli attacks when it was bombed on October 17, 2023. At least 471 Palestinians were killed at that time, including many displaced persons, patients, and medical staff. Without providing any real evidence, the Israeli occupation army claims that the Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas operatives were using hospitals as a command and control installation. Since the start of the war on the Palestinians in Gaza, Israel has deliberately destroyed 34 hospitals in Gaza and withheld food, water, medicine, and all other humanitarian assistance from Gaza residents. And those are our headlines for today. Now, here's Andrew with our first longer story.
China announced new tariffs on Friday for U.S.-made goods. The rates for the tariffs vary from between 84 to 125%. Earlier in the week, the U.S. had raised tariffs on Chinese-made goods to 145%. In the statement announcing the tariffs, the Chinese Finance Ministry said, quote, if the U.S. insists on continuing to substantially infringe on China's interests, China will resolutely counter and fight to the end, unquote. In addition to tariffs, China is experienced at using other tactics in trade battles and to protect its own industries. Over the past 4 months, the Chinese government has reduced direct exports of major commodities, including beef, poultry, and liquefied natural gas, using techniques broadly described as non-tariff barriers. Many experts expect that the Chinese government will use these types of tactics to subject U.S. industries friendly with the Trump administration to additional trade interference. China is the major supplier of critical minerals for many industries, and production disruptions could have serious consequences for U.S. companies. China's leader, Xi Jinping, met with Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez on Friday before the newest tariffs were announced, and stated that his country and the European Union should, quote, jointly resist the unilateral bullying practices of the Trump administration. The Chinese leader is scheduled to visit Malaysia, Vietnam, and Cambodia next week, all countries that are targets of U.S. tariffs. Government ministers have also been meeting with officials from South Africa, Saudi Arabia, and India, promoting greater trade cooperation. Experts expect China will be a more formidable foe in the current trade war and not likely to cave to U.S. demands. Exports to the U.S. account for just 2% of China's GDP, and their distribution capabilities, especially through e-commerce platforms, continue to grow around the world. China said it will not respond with more tariff increases if the U.S. continues to raise tariffs.
The U.N. Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said yesterday that in Sudan, the paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, at war with the regular Sudanese army since April 2023, had launched coordinated ground and aerial assaults on the western city of El Fasher and the Zamzam and Abu Shouk displacement camps. Activists said Friday the full extent of the damage in the camps remains unclear because of internet shutdowns and communication disruptions, but the Sudanese Foreign Ministry and aid groups said on Saturday that the attacks have left hundreds dead or wounded in what some described as one of the worst violations since the war began. Reuters quotes the advocacy group, the General Coordination of Displaced Persons and Refugees, as saying the assaults began on Thursday and continued through Friday and Saturday, destroying homes, markets, and healthcare facilities. UN Humanitarian Coordinator in Sudan, Clementine Nkweta Salami, said the state in a statement yesterday that civilians were killed in Abu Shouk and Zamzam camps, which host over 700,000 displaced people, many of whom are now trapped without safe refuge. Relief International, the last organization providing critical services at Zamzam camp, reported that its clinic was overtaken and 9 staff members, including doctors and drivers, were killed. The RSF dismissed allegations of atrocities and accused its rivals of orchestrating a media campaign using actors and staged scenes to falsely incriminate them. The U.S. State Department said it was deeply alarmed by reports of attacks by the RSF on Zamzam and Abu Shouk and condemned them. And British Foreign Secretary David Lammy described the reports of indiscriminate RSF attacks as shocking. The UK, Germany, and France are bringing together foreign ministers from nearly 20 countries and organizations in London on Tuesday in an attempt to establish a group that can bring the warring factions in Sudan closer toward peace. They have not invited the two warring parties, the Sudanese Armed Forces or the RSF, who are judged to be a long way from seeking peace. The effort in London seeks to secure a consensus among rival external backers. NGOs such as Human Rights Watch are also urging the ministerial conference to emphasize the importance of civilian protection, independent of a ceasefire.
A general strike was called on Thursday in Argentina to protest Javier Milei's massive spending cuts. Teachers, train conductors, customs officials, trash collectors, and postal workers, among many others, all walked off the job for the duration of the day, effectively halting many of the country's most important operations. Government officials estimated that the stoppage cost the country nearly $880 million. As a result of the strike, all domestic flights in the country were canceled, and metro operation in the capital city of Buenos Aires, as well as other municipalities, were suspended. The strike was organized to protest deep cuts to Argentina's government spending and operations. Over 42,000 government employees have been fired as a result of the cuts. Strikers demanded increased spending on health and education, the reinstatement of fired government employees, and the reopening of wage negotiations for workers. Thursday's strike was a third of its kind organized by Argentina's powerful unions since Milei took office 16 months ago. Nestor Segovia, a representative of the subway's workers' union, said, quote, "We are joining the strike for fair collective bargaining, solidarity with retirees and the country's poorest, and for the crisis that we are experiencing. Milei's administration criticized the strike, labeling it as an attack on the public led by corrupt unions. Manuel Adorni, spokesperson for Milei, stated, quote, "This strike pursues political interests and has nothing to do with the workers. It's one of the last gasps of those who live off extortion and pressure," unquote. Since taking office, the Trump administration has expressed admiration for Milei's libertarian policies and massive spending cuts, with the U.S. Treasury saying that Milei, quote, "brought Argentina back from economic oblivion." U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent is scheduled to travel to Buenos Aires on Monday to express support for Milei.
Difficult weather conditions hit several Asian countries this week. In Nepal, the capital Kathmandu has been covered by a toxic haze, a combination of smoke from wildfires burning in the area and the general pollutants of vehicle exhaust, brick kilns, open waste burning, with dust from construction sites contributing to the problem. The city's air quality is ranked among the worst in the world, partly due to the city's location in a valley which traps stagnant air. Kathmandu is also one of the world's fastest developing, with the number of vehicles rising by 14% each year. In India, the Indian Meteorological Department, or IMD, has warned of temperatures over 100 degrees Fahrenheit in parts of northern India, including the capital Delhi, for next week. Heat waves in northern India between April and June are normal, but in recent years, extreme temperatures are arriving earlier and lasting longer. Last week, the IMD chief Marutunji Mohapatra said the most parts of India would experience an intense heat wave this summer, with above normal temperatures expected across most of the country. He said from April to June, most parts of the north and east India, central India, and the plains of northwest are expected to experience 2 to 4 more heat wave days than normal, unquote. Last year, India recorded its hottest day ever at 123 degrees Fahrenheit. More than 40,000 suspected cases of heat stroke were reported from that heat wave. In China's capital, Beijing, high winds and sandstorms caused the government to cancel flights, close public spaces, and issue warnings to citizens to stay indoors last week. China's sandstorms originate in the Gobi and Taklamakan deserts in China's dry north. It has been working for years to reduce these storms and predicts fewer of them will occur in the coming year compared to historical averages. It has worked with Mongolia and other Central Asian countries to restore land in danger of becoming desert. Li Xiaosong, a researcher at the Chinese Academy of Sciences, told the China Daily in an interview, quote, "While climate change influences year-to-year dust activity, sustained ecological restoration is the cornerstone of long-term reduction," unquote.
In Jerusalem, Israeli occupation forces prevented Palestinian Christian citizens from the West Bank from reaching occupied Jerusalem on Sunday to participate in Palm Sunday services. Eastern and Western Christian churches observe Palm Sunday, the last Sunday before Easter, and the commemoration of Christ's entry into Jerusalem. Israeli occupation forces imposed strict military measures at checkpoints surrounding Jerusalem and the Old City. Israeli authorities require Palestinians, both Muslims and Christians, to obtain special permits by downloading a special application on their mobile devices and applying for a permit, which is often denied. Palestinian citizens who do get permits are then forced to cross multiple Israeli military checkpoints surrounding the Holy City and access places of worship, especially Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The Deputy Superior General of the Custody of the Holy Land, Father Ibrahim Faltas, said, quote, "The occupation forces has issued only 6,000 permits for Palestinian Christians from the West Bank governorates, despite the estimated 50,000 Christians in those governorates." He said, quote, "For the second year in a row, a small number of pilgrims are participating in the Holy Week and Easter prayers in Jerusalem due to the repercussions of the war," unquote. Vatas noted that, quote, "The churches will offer their prayers for peace, justice, and freedom for all the people of the Holy Land." The traditional Palm Sunday procession of the Catholic Church will depart this afternoon from the Church of Bay Fahad to the Church of St. Anne in Salaheh within the walls of the Old City, after which a special prayer service will be held. Churches have canceled all festive events during the holidays in light of the ongoing Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip since October 7, 2023. Holidays are limited to masses, prayers, and religious rites. Palm Sunday prayers were also held in Palestinian Christian churches in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. In Gaza City, Palm Sunday masses and prayers were held at the Latin Church of the Holy Family and the Greek Orthodox Church of St. Porphyrus. Despite the, quote, "harsh, brutal conditions imposed by the ongoing Israeli destruction of the Gaza Strip."
Voting is underway today for Ecuador's presidential runoff between incumbent President Daniel Noboa and leftist candidate Luisa Gonzalez. In the first round of elections in February, Noboa narrowly beat out Gonzalez by a margin of 0.17% of the vote in a country where voting is mandatory. The focus of this election has primarily been the rising levels of crime in the country since 2021, tied to the trafficking of cocaine produced in neighboring Colombia and Peru. Both candidates support tough-on-crime policies, pledge additional government resources for law enforcement, as well as a platform of international cooperation to combat drug cartels and gangs responsible for the violence in the country. However, there are distinct differences between the platforms of the two candidates. During his presidency, Noboa has focused on activity combating violent crime by declaring multiple states of emergency and deploying thousands of troops to combat gangs in the country. He has also labeled those with ties to violent gangs as terrorists and began the construction of a new maximum security prison. Irene Valdez, a retiree who voted for Noboa, said, quote, "My vote is clear. I want to continue living in freedom," unquote. During Noboa's first term, the homicide rate dropped from 46.18 per 100,000 people in 2023 to 38.76 per 100,000 people in 2024. However, an early spike in 2025 has caused some voters to question the efficiency of Noboa's policies. Additionally, some of Noboa's tactics have been criticized as too heavy-handed and testing the limits of executive power in an effective democracy. Gonzalez proposes an alternative focus for combating violence in the country, a model she describes as, quote, "prevention, violence reduction, and coexistence," unquote. Her plan includes increasing social spending to support low-income communities where crime rates are the highest. Martin Constante, a university student, said, quote, "I think Luisa Gonzalez is going to change things because Noboa has been very authoritarian. Our country needs a lot of changes," unquote. And that's the news from around the world for April 13th, 2025. I'm Lee Rowe.
And I'm Andrew Karn.
And sources we used to prepare today's stories were Africa News, Agence France-Presse, Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera, All Africa, Anadolu, the Associated Press, the BBC, China Daily, Deutsche Welle, France 24, The Guardian, IRNA, The Middle East Monitor, NPR, Politico, Reuters, and The Times of India. And so now we're going to take a little break so El Haji and Gil can get situated in the studio, and we'll be right back.
Welcome to the April 13th edition of the Worldview feature. I'm your host, Gil Halstead. And today my guest is Alhaji Njai. Alhaji is well known to WORT listeners as the former host of the Pan-Africa show. And he is known internationally for his work on biomedicine, global health, and his role on the 1808 project, where most recently he's been involved in the launching of the Kouinadougou College in his hometown of Kabala, Sierra Leone.
Yeah.
He's been a frequent guest on Worldview. Most recently, we wish we saw more of him, but it was back in October of last year. And now we welcome you back again to Worldview. Since we last spoke, you've been very busy.
Absolutely. I think I often don't even know where I am.
Right. Well, we're glad that you're here. And actually, I wanted to try to remind you of some of the places that you've been. So maybe that will help us get at some of the really interesting things that you've been doing. I was kind of thinking of sort of like a DJ. You've been a DJ.
Yeah. Yeah.
You review the tracks of music that you've been spinning for listeners, you know, at the end of a set.
Yeah.
Right, for the past half hour. So I thought we'd sort of take a little bit of that approach right now, at least sure. to get started.
Sure.
So I was going to begin with, I think it's just last week mm-hmm. that you were in Addis Ababa.
Yeah.
And what were you doing there? You celebrated the end of Ramadan, but you were there for a particular purpose that has to do with medical research and mm-hmm. prioritization of framework at the African Center for Disease Control. We've just been talking about that before mm-hmm. we sat down to talk to listeners right now. So what were you doing in Addis Ababa?
So yeah, I you know, actually I did my Eid, which is the festival after the Ramadan. I did it right on the plane flying to Addis. So all the celebration happened in the plane. But you know, I was in Addis because you know, Africa CDC is working with us, a group of scientists across in over 16 African countries, to try to now develop a framework for research in Africa, research and development, but also research prioritization, governance of research across the continent, also creating an ethical framework or ethics framework that is African-centered, and then working towards a mapping and implementation of research and R&D across Africa. Because, you know, Africa, if you think about it, only 1-3% of global research R&D happens in Africa. And yet there is a lot of data, a lot of resources, a lot of work that happens in the continent. So we are trying to change that. We are trying to make sure that we sort of begin to advance African-centered R&D and prioritizing issues in Africa.
And when you say we, who is the we that is doing that?
Yes, so the we with Africa Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the Africa CDC, which is the umbrella. It covers 54 countries in Africa. It's very similar to US CDC. It's sort of the U.S. mission of Africa.
Its mission and the work that it actually does is similar, which has right. to do with disease control.
Disease control and health for all, protecting the health of the African populations. And so we think that, a healthy continent, a healthy African population, especially having a more young population across the continent, is critical for development. And it's also fundamental, along with developing the R&D, also comes with developing science and technology and also even the social sciences across the continent.
And so that what's the next step in that process? I mean, just before we came on the air, you're continuing to work. We're working on sort of following up on what you were doing in Addis Ababa.
Yes.
What's the next step?
So, critically, the next steps now is rolling things across the continent. So we launched it with the ministers in Addis on the 1st of April, and now we are piloting in Togo and Benin, and then the next couple months will be piloting it or spreading it across the continent, so we can everyone across Africa can now be working on the same framework, under the same framework. We can now coordinate centers across Africa. We can also now coordinate the priorities we are working on, so that it's not like this one is working on this, this person is working on this. Right. We can now begin to prioritize it across the continent. But also more so is we are also developing an implementation of the ethics, African-centered ethics, strengthening the ethics across Africa, regulatory, because that's one of our major challenges when it comes to research in Africa. For far too long, people have been taking advantage of Africans in terms of research, where most people sometimes in the continent have not been benefiting from the research communities, did not benefit from research happening in their communities, or even research involving their own bodies to make vaccines or therapies. We've had situations where when it comes to even academic knowledge, I was telling you earlier, you know, where publications, Africans are sometimes not included in major publications where the research has happened in the continent. And so
these are situations where they actually played a role in providing the data and maybe even in gathering it, and they're not recognized.
And they are not recognized. Yeah. And even the communities from where it's coming from doesn't get the benefit back from it. And even during the Ebola and many of these other emergencies, we see where unproven medications, unproven therapies, unproven vaccines were being used on bodies that have not been, you know, officially recognized. So we are trying to change that. And so the African-centered ethical framework also incorporates the African culture. Because within the African culture, you know, as I was saying earlier, our African cultures are more communal in nature. And also we focus on issues around moral duty, where it is about not just about me, it's about the community, it's about peace, it's about solidarity, it's about character. And so ethics within the African framework is not necessarily about individual, about personhood, about rights. It's about really about a moral duty. And so we want to kind of reframe ethics, but by bringing in and building with an African-centered approach.
I think it makes sense to check in with you also, Alhaji, a sense of what's been going on here.
Yes.
In the United States since the election of Donald Trump and I keep referring it to as kind of carnage that's going on around us in terms of the way things are being changed. But things that affect exactly what you're talking about in Africa, how big an impact have you been seeing of these cuts, in particular in AID? I think is what we are hearing the most about in terms of impact it's having outside the United States. Okay, we hear about AID people losing their jobs. I mean, many of these are Americans. That's what we hear about here. But what about the projects? Are any of these related to the kind of work that you're doing that have had significant impacts?
Absolutely. I think, there's been a huge impact across the continent. Let's say when you take USAID or you take any of the programs across Africa, they were major in terms of things like malaria, HIV, tuberculosis, a lot of other major programs that have been impacted. And people who work in projects that are related to some of this funding are definitely affected across the continent, and the impacts there are huge, because some of these people depended on some of these jobs. But we also had a high dependency rate in the continent for many years on aid like this. and which, you know, again, many of the countries were taking, maybe, you know, were not, maybe they were not ready, you know, to for the abrupt changes. But by and large, I think it also brings up opportunities for the continent, opportunities for us to begin to think about our priorities differently. We begin to think about pathways for domestic funding, more domestic funding, pathways to kind of be more innovative in the way we kind of either do our research or do our work with communities. And also, I think in a way, it's something that we should should have been more prepared for in terms of sustainability. Because for all the years, people have been talking about sustainability. How do we build sustainability in our programs? And I think that if we, have to learn anything from whatever is happening now globally, it's about, how do we begin to create more opportunities for entrepreneurship, more opportunities for sustainability, more opportunities for leadership, but also it is an opportunity for us to begin to reprioritize on the things that are more important. I mean, I think USAID and a lot of other entities were doing great work within the continent, and that was a fantastic work they were doing. But I think at this point, more and more of Africans and more people across the continent are saying, how do we, begin to take things forward and move things and take more ownership and then create the leadership, create the sustainability needed and begin to kind of shift our priorities, because sometimes again, the priorities often that was pushed by donors wasn't the priorities that were there for local entities and local governments. So by and large, I think it is, in a way to me, it's maybe a wake-up call and it's opening an opportunity for communities to begin to think within. And then by thinking within, it is now allowing them to kind of domesticate, things, ideas that were normally put in the back bench, in the back burner.
So a positive way to look at it, of opportunity for, rather than, responding with anger and feeling of how can we get back at this and blame. It's more you want to focus more on what does this prompt us to do on our own now and to reconsider. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think that's, to me, it's really the fundamental thing to think around. Like, countries, many of the countries have been on aid for over 60 years. And yes, aid is good, and it was supporting important causes like let's say malaria, tuberculosis, water, and many other things. But let's say now, for after 60 years, you should begin to kind of be a little bit more able to take care of your own issues and able to think and begin to solve some of those challenges. So to me, what the focus should be now is more about capacity. How do we build capability and build capacity? The African continent is rife with young people, talented young people, really, really talented young people. And now is the era in which we will have to kind of rethink our philosophies, rethink about how do we solve poverty on a greater scale across the continent, and how do we build entrepreneurship among the populations, and how do we create real leadership to solve the issues that are of importance.
Right, and speaking of that, looking at this list of activities since you were last with us, moving now back to March. I wanted to, I mean, it fits in talking about young people and the things that they can be involved in, mm-hmm. because I see here this list of activities, the Kuinadugu College students and staff community observational walk for a firsthand experience of their environment and land use change,
mm-hmm.
providing experiential learning to students, bridging theoretical learnings in public health, emergency and disaster management studies.
Mm-hmm.
This is a focus on what is going on in a college in your hometown.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, fits in with, you know, my, you know, discussion now. And it's been, you know, sort of what I had envisaged years ago when I was here in Wisconsin. And I said about creating an institution where we begin to build real capacities. We begin to decolonize our education. We begin to find ways in which we domesticate modernization by, you know, going back to understanding some of our indigenous ideas, but also how do we build sustainability, we build leadership, and we build entrepreneurship. And for me, it ties in with whatever is happening currently, because really we had a situation in all across Africa because of historically issues of poverty and despair, to the point where young people almost always wanted to leave at all cost. They want to leave. People risk their lives in the Mediterranean, oceans to right. die in boats to go to Europe. Now, how do we change this? We have to change this, because we can only change this by bringing hope, by showing hope. And how do we show hope? Is by actually ensuring that people see avenues where they can change resources. They can be able to utilize their resources in their environment, and where they can also grow wealth in their own environment. And so we need to kind of refocus that. If people begin growing wealth in their environment, we are building a generation of leaders who think about collective success. We are thinking about sustainability in a way, in, you know, within the African continent. Then there will be no issues of people really trying to leave and come to the U.S. You know, it could just be about choice at that moment, and rather than about despair.
Right.
So I think that's what we really need to kind of work on. And for me, it's been my work for many, many years before this time. And I think what we are really working on in places like Kuinadugu in Sierra Leone, which is, if you take by all indices in Sierra Leone, it's one of the least developed districts in the country. And Sierra Leone happens to be probably in the 184, 85 countries out of 87 countries in Human Development Index, ranked 186 out of 187 of the most unhappy countries in the world. And only
how can they be so unhappy when I see you smiling so broadly there? They're
yeah.
No,
yeah.
I understand.
No, well, yeah, you know, yeah, and I think that's the key. You know, we smile a lot over okay. over a lot of trauma,
yes.
and I think that's right. that's the beauty of you know, of this smile that we have. Yes, but I think you know, it's a combination of factors. You know, it's a small country, but by and large, we've never had a break since independence. It has been tumultuous. It has been very checkered from 1960 through 70s, and then the 70s to the 80s, we started seeing rapid decline. You know, due to, you know, changes in IMF and all that. And then right around the 80s, corruption kicked in so hard within those government systems, and things went really bad and sour in the country, to the point that we went into a civil war, one of the most terrible wars in Africa.
In the continent,
and
yeah.
Right. And then, you know, and then going out of that war 10 years from 1990 to 2001, only a few years, we didn't have time to take a break and reflect and even have opportunities to reintegrate, reconstruct and all of that stuff. Then Ebola struck, and one of the most terrible Ebola outbreaks in Africa in 2014. And of course, since then, we've had just one thing after the other. So I think there is a lot of inbuilt trauma, and that trauma is normalized in countries like Sierra Leone and when you combine trauma and poverty and daily structural violence, it makes for a very unhappy person.
And you were talking, I mean, addressing some of these issues last month. I'm looking at the list of your activities here. You were speaking at a closed-door ministerial roundtable mm-hmm. on bolstering Africa's emergency preparedness and response, and looking at, you just talked about the Ebola outbreak, mm-hmm. lessons from that and other disease outbreaks, and this was taking place in Kigali, Rwanda, just yeah. next door to Sierra Leone, right?
Well, it's a little bit out, further okay. out in the east, in Rwanda. But it was on a closed-door ministerial meeting. I was fortunate to be invited to address, African ministers in that conference, the African Health Conference. It's a very big conference. And I was selected last year by a group called Global Health Strategies to become a voice for global health issues across Africa. And so as one of the leading voices of global health in the continent, they thought that, I should be the right person, telling things to our ministers. But maybe also it's because I'm sometimes very unfiltered. unfiltered in what I say, but it was an opportunity for us to think to come in with new ways of thinking around emergencies and around how African governments and African leaders can prepare more towards building resilience within the continent when it comes to epidemic preparedness and response across the continent. And I think it was an important meeting where we were able to bring out some salient issues, but salient also critical things that needs to be considered. And it's important because it was also happening within this period where greater independence is needed, greater domestic funding is needed, greater thinking around African-led solutions, African prioritization of our own issues is needed. So I think it was an important meeting, and I was very happy to be there and also to force ourselves to begin to think out of the box, even though it is always hard for us to think out of the box because most of Africa, we are still in the box.
Right.
So, how do you think out of the box when you are still inside the box? So it was really to kind of help us to kind of move out of the box.
Right.
And begin to think about, even the ways in which we define ourselves. I was saying that we say, for instance, we are resource limited. And we write these things a lot in our papers.
That
in
you're
our
resource
proposals.
Limited. What does it mean? What resource are you limited
That's
in?
Right. So I keep asking, what resources are we limited in? Yeah. And so when you begin to kind of accept those definitions of who you are, then you become, a handicap in the way you are going to do things because you are always thinking, oh my God, I need help. I need this person to give me something because I am resource limited. You are resource limited? No. We are resource wasteful. It is about being resource wasteful. And I think that was the point that I wanted to tell to our ministers at the point, because, how could one guy have a convoy of 10 vehicles and then the local hospital doesn't have an ambulance?
Mm-hmm.
right? And then you say, oh, we don't have resources. But you have. You already have 10 vehicles behind you as a convoy, but you don't have an ambulance for your hospital, mm-hmm. or you cannot light your electricity. And we have countries with so much resources. When I look at my country, like Sierra Leone, and I look at all the neighboring countries, Guinea, Liberia, and most of these other countries, I see countries that are seated on huge resources, yeah. right? Currently, we have scarcity of water when I was living in Sierra Leone. And we are a country that has, on average, over 10 major rivers. And we get rain for almost 8 to 9 months of the year. And why do you have scarcity of water? and then that lends itself to electricity. You have over 9 to 10 major rivers that actually have waterfalls as they flow down. You can't make HEP, hydroelectric power. You can't have that. You have 12 months of sunshine. You can take use of solar energy and all those things. So how do we become more innovative
right.
and begin to take the necessary leadership in our countries?
Well, and that's what you were talking about with the ministers and the conferences you've been to. Just trying to encourage people to look at those resources and not think of when you say we are resource limited, it sounds like to me like often that means we just don't have money.
Yes.
But what about all these resources that you've just listed off that we have?
Absolutely. And you know, my thing is that I always say that we have the resources in the world to solve poverty. And all we need to do is to distribute these resources from people from so much more wealth to those who have nothing. And I think we can solve poverty around the world. It's just that we need to be deliberate
and we need to listen to each other and communicate.
Exactly. Communicate, be more empathetic.
But I have to cut off our communication now because our time has ended.
Yes.
But I was just saying in the control room there that, you know, we're going to have Alhaji come one time and he will spend the hour.
Absolutely.
And Neil said I'd listen to that hour. So anyway, thank you, Alhaji, for coming. We appreciate you.
Thank you.
We appreciate you. All the work you're doing.
Thank you.
And I have to also thank our Third World Collective members, Neil Adams, Sabia Tiye, Chuck Benish, Andrew Karn, Gil Halstead, and Amitabh Paul for bringing the international news to WORT listeners. And thanks also to WORT News and Public Affairs Director, Shali Pittman. And we have to thank especially our listeners. So we want to thank you for listening. And please join us next week for a new edition of Worldview here on your community-sponsored radio station, WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org, or on the app. And now stay tuned for Salamat.
The WORT Board of Directors will hold its regularly scheduled meeting on Wednesday, April 16th at 6 p.m. in person at the station, 118 South Bedford Street. The public is welcome to attend. Meeting attendance is also available via Zoom. For information on how to attend this meeting virtually, please email president@wordfm.org.
السلام عليكم طب اس السلام عليكم اس السلام عليكم طب اس السلام عليكم السلام عليكم السلام عليكم السلام عليكم
In Arabic أعطوا الأجير أجره قبل أن يجف عرقه
Yeah.
Translation: give the laborer his wages before his sweat dries.
This is actually one of the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, may God bless him and grant him peace.